Welcome back to the Annie Fry Show. We got to start the show. I love the off-air conversations with Will Scharf, but we got to bring him on air with you. And Will, we haven't talked to you on the air since Donald Trump has become president-elect Donald Trump. You feel pretty good about that one?
Annie, I am not tired of winning yet. It has been an incredible week for America. I think we're all having a lot of fun, and I think the next couple weeks are going to be even more fun. So it's exciting stuff.
When you were in, were you at the victory party?
Yeah, I was down in West Palm. Actually,
set
I called,
the stage for us.
So, I mean, obviously thousands of people. We were sort of upstairs in like a hold room. I saw some great Missourians there. Congressman Jason Smith was around. Senator Eric Schmidt with some old buddies of his was hanging around. I was there. My colleague John Sauer was there. So Missouri was well represented at the party. You know, it's a long night. You get there at 6, 7 p.m. and the race, you know, President Trump didn't end up speaking until about 3 a.m. Eastern. Now, as some of your listeners may know, I called the race early.
Yes,
as
you
I
did.
Started, I called the race at 7:44 p.m. Eastern. I'd seen early returns from Indiana and Kentucky that showed Trump running about 1.5 points above where he'd been in 2020.
Wow.
And that was enough for me to call the race. Everyone thought I was crazy. I was running around the party saying, "It's over, guys, it's over." And everyone else was a little more nervous than I was. I'm glad I was right because it would have been really embarrassing. but I was on with, I think it was Reardon and yeah. John Lamping. And they were being like super squishy, which I wasn't really expecting from John Lamping. And I said, guys, you know, 95% certainty. I hedged a little bit. It is done. It is dusted. President Trump is the next president of the United States of America.
When we did our watch party on our YouTube channel while Mark Reardon held down the fort here, when we would hear that you were going to be on, we're like, let's listen to Will. Like, we'll shut up and we'll listen to Will. I mean, our relationship with you on this station, we're so grateful for it. You've been at the, like, very near the epicenter of so much American history in the last, how long would it be? Year? 18 months? That you've been really, really close to the center here?
Yeah, you know, started doing work on all this lawfare stuff. I guess it was, you know, the spring of 2023 and formally joined the president's team last August. It's been a wild, wild ride. And I'm just deeply grateful to have had the opportunities that I've had. And I'm deeply grateful that we've had the successes that we've had, because I think beating back this campaign of lawfare really was very important, not just for President Trump, but for the American Republic, for the Constitution, for all the things we hold dear.
Yeah, you know, it was such a tenuous moment. We're not done with it yet. As I understand it, we've got news today on the Mershon hush money porn star case for Donald Trump in New York. But if, you know, what America decided in this election, I don't think it's too tall of an order to say it was going to make or break the future of this country. When it comes to the people who are in office, able to wield the powers of the justice system against political opponents. I keep saying this. They impeached Donald Trump over that with his phone call with Zelensky. The first impeachment was they were saying that he was trying to dig up dirt on a political opponent who happened to be not even the nominee yet, Joe Biden. They did all of that to the nth degree. If Kamala Harris would have won, what was your fear for Donald Trump and his ability to be free of this lawfare?
Yeah, I mean, look, Kamala Harris being president would be a terribly scary situation for any number of reasons. I mean, seriously, fear for the future of the republic. One of the interesting things, though, is you go back to the first impeachment, you go back to the Russia collusion hoax, and what you see in all of those instances is, you know, we call it the deep state. It's folks within the government who believe that their personal policy preferences, their personal views are more important than the opinions of the American people expressed through their elected representatives. So with the Russia collusion hoax, you saw these guys at CIA and FBI who basically took it upon themselves to attempt to rig the 2016 election. With the first impeachment, you saw these sort of deep staters who were so infuriated by some of President Trump's policy decisions that they felt that their views were more important than those of the elected president of the United States of America. as we move into the second Trump administration, to me, that's the great challenge. How do we recenter American government so that it's truly reflective of the will of the people and so that it empowers our elected representatives to do the will of the people? This deep state phenomenon, conservatives love to talk about it, but what we're really talking about is several thousand people in D.C. who think they know better than all of us. And that's just not the way America is supposed to work.
To use a Corinne Jean-Pierre phrase, do you believe that President Trump and his administration are clear-eyed in how to accomplish the resetting of that justice system to be blind to these types of things that have caused them in the past to make different judgments?
You know, I'll say this. You look at the appointments that he's made so far in this transition, and there has not been a miss. Susie Wiles will be an outstanding chief of staff. Waltz was, I think, a perfect pick for national security advisor.
Mike Waltz.
Mike Huckabee, you know, ambassador to Israel. Mm-hmm. Elise Stefanik, ambassador to the UN. I think President Trump is sending a very clear message about what the government under him is going to look like and what America is going to stand for around the world. And then you look at sort of closer to home appointments. I mean, Stephen Miller, obviously one of the key masterminds of Trump's successful border and immigration policies the first time around. He's now deputy chief of staff for policy in the White House, an incredibly important position. And then at his side is going to be Homan, you know, on as our new border czar. Think about it. The clearest contrast imaginable. We went from Kamala Harris's border czar to Homan, who's probably the single best person on this issue in the country. I mean, that's what winning looks like. And I'm expecting to see a lot more good news in the next couple days as President Trump continues staffing up this administration.
We're speaking with Will Scharf in studio, a former federal prosecutor for the Eastern District of Missouri. He's also one of Donald Trump's attorneys. I'm going to read to you what the rest of us non-legal experts are consuming about the ruling or whatever you call it that came out today in the hush money trial where Donald Trump was convicted of 34 felonies. He's not a convicted felon. I've learned that from you, Will Scharf, but I've heard that from many other legal experts. You're not a convicted felon until you've been sentenced. The Fox News report is that a Manhattan judge overseeing President-elect Donald Trump's trial agreed to grant a stay on all deadlines associated with a felony conviction proceedings against Trump in the final months before he takes office, a closely watched decision that allows Trump to avoid a maximum sentence of up to 4 years in prison. The judge overseeing the case, Judge Juan Merchan, granted the request, which issues a stay on all deadlines, including the November 26 sentencing date, to consider the effect of his election as president. Simplify this in the most elementary of terms, Will, what was this ruling today for
Donald
Trump?
So we had a jury verdict against President Trump in this New York case, which was an absolute garbage case. We call it the zombie case. We then moved to overturn that jury verdict on the basis of presidential immunity, that they introduced all kinds of evidence in that case that shouldn't have been allowed inside that courtroom in light of the Supreme Court's opinion in our presidential immunity appeal that came down on July 1st. That's an issue that we're currently litigating, and we were expecting a ruling from Judge Merchan on that this week. Now, if he were to rule against us on that, we would have a right to appeal, and we could potentially go all the way back up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Once that whole process had played out, potentially a sentencing could occur, and then we'd have the right to appeal that sentencing, appeal that judgment, again, all the way up through the court system to the New York Court of Appeals, the highest court in New York, and again, potentially to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, I say all of that because it is absolute black letter law that you cannot criminally prosecute or exercise any sort of criminal sanction against a sitting president of the United States of America. You can't throw a president in jail. You can't indict him. You can't put him on trial. You cannot do any of that because of the take care clause in Article 2 of the Constitution and the supremacy clause of the U.S. Constitution. So I think what's become clear in this New York case is by the time they could resolve all of these legal issues, President Trump's going to be back where he belongs in the White House, and none of this is really going to be relevant. So my suspicion is that in the coming weeks, we're going to see that case unwound the same way that we've seen the federal prosecutions move towards final resolution. And I, I've said this before on your show, Annie. I don't think President Trump will ever be sentenced in that New York case. I don't believe that verdict will end up standing. And I certainly don't think that's going to happen before he takes office.
Does that mean that Donald Trump will be absolved, that this would be expunged, that he has not been convicted? Is the conviction overturned? Like, what is the legalese behind what that means for what we've already seen take place?
So if we were to win on this presidential immunity issue, that would be an overturning of the jury verdict.
Can that happen before the inauguration?
It could. The other option is that Alvin Bragg's team may just drop this case. That would be irregular because they've already gone through a jury trial. But potentially, they could just look at the challenges inherent in criminally prosecuting a president-elect or a sitting president and say that, you know, guys, we just can't do this. It's over. And move to dismiss the case. And if Judge Merchan then granted that, it would effectively wipe the slate clean. It's really important to remember, though, and I'll say this again, you cannot criminally prosecute a president. You cannot impose a sentence on a sitting president. And I think there are very strong arguments that even a president-elect, because of the statutory duties that a president-elect has, the Supremacy Clause comes into play here, and a state prosecution like this New York prosecution simply cannot proceed now that President Trump has been reelected.
I think when a lot of Americans across the country are looking at Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg and New York Attorney General Letitia James, there seems to be a lot of malpractice. It seems to be very disconcerting that this type of lawfare can be levied against a citizen. Do they only answer to the people of Manhattan and New York?
You know, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens to these bad actors in the next couple months. I hope that the American people understand that what they've done to President Trump simply can't happen again. We can't have this situation where the courts, where prosecution, where even civil actions are weaponized in this way for political purposes, because I truly believe that if that becomes the new norm, it will signal the end of the republic, that we can't have a robust Democratic Republic if the tools of law are going to be misused the way that they have been misused. Tish James has been saying, I think, some outrageous things since the election about how she's going to continue fighting Trump and all that sort of thing. I hope that cooler heads prevail, and I hope that they start to understand that what they've done is just a terribly, terribly wrong thing. You know, I spoke at a press conference after we had appellate arguments in one of the E. Jean Carroll cases, and I said to the press, guys, this is insane. I mean, we can't have a situation where the courts are misused in this way for political purposes. That's not what the courts are designed for. That's not what the law is designed for. We contest elections at the ballot box in America. The American people spoke loudly and clearly last Tuesday, and I think all of these political actors on the left need to take their cue from that.
Well, Will said at the beginning, he's not tired of all the winning in either way. I just feel very just like the baseline level of happy in my life has dramatically increased in the last week. I actually feel like I breathe full inhales and full exhales right now instead of all those short breaths when you get really nervous. It's good to be on this side of the election, and it's great to have Will Scharf in studio with us. You're going to stick around for another segment, right?
Yeah, sure.
All right. We'll finish out the 1 o'clock hour with Will Scharf in studio, former federal prosecutor for the Eastern District of Missouri, Donald Trump attorney in studio with us here on the Andy Frye Show. Go to the YouTube live and vote in today's poll. Do you trust Trump's judgment on his cabinet picks? Yes or no? A lot of them keep coming. The latest that we've heard here is Ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee. It's another good one. Let us know what you think on the Andy Frye YouTube channel. Come say hi. We'll be right back.
Five ain't working. Why the hell do I work?
They all allege that these actions were made on my own recognizance and that it was for my own political advances. However, if you look at the record, there is what we call a community trend. And unfortunately, it just so happened that the political hostility that was encountered by my team, and I was on two different teams during this deployment, they just so happened to have the Trump campaign signage. FEMA always preaches avoidance first and then de-escalation. So this is not isolated. This is a colossal event of avoidance, not just in the state of Florida, but you will find avoidance in the Carolinas.
That is a fired FEMA employee, Marnie Washington, saying she told her team to avoid Trump homes because of hostility. And this was larger than her. We've got Will Scharf in studio with us for the rest of this hour. Will, I don't know how much you've heard about this story, but it is like, it is, even at this point, nothing really should surprise me. But I know where I was sitting and what I was doing when I read this story, that FEMA was advising their volunteers or whatever agents to skip over homes in Florida in the wake of the hurricane that indicated support for Trump.
Yeah, it's really funny. You know, when you prosecute a street-level drug dealer, if they're facing real time, if they're facing real punishment, more often than not, they will rat out their superiors and they will rat out the organization that they're working for. When you hold a federal bureaucrat accountable the way they did this FEMA employee, she immediately ratted out the larger organization and the bigger picture, which isn't just she was some rogue person discriminating against Trump supporters. What she reveals in that clip that you just played is that this was FEMA policy to effectively discriminate in disaster relief aid against Trump supporters. That is an outrageous scandal. I hope that we get to the bottom of it under the new administration. But just that mindset is so fascinating to me, that these people felt empowered enough to go out and do something that is so clearly wrong, just at a basic moral level wrong, and that she didn't really even see anything wrong with it.
It's so important to think about it in that mentality. Like, if I'm ever doing anything that I'm even considering, like, maybe this isn't 100% right, I have a guilty conscience about me that it's incredibly hindering for me to proceed with whatever that action is. But to be so casual about, like, I'm thinking to my mind, like, why did you type that out?
Yeah.
Why would you type out to skip Trump homes if you are willing to type that out? And if you're willing to attest to it in an almost casual way, FEMA can't be the only place that has this mentality.
Yeah, I think these federal bureaucrats just don't think they're accountable to anybody. And they've never been held accountable before. I mean, if this was the policy now, I promise you it was the policy, or that there was a similar policy a year ago, 2 years ago, 4 years ago. I mean, this is baked into the federal bureaucracy. And the greatest challenge President Trump and his team have ahead of them is unwinding this insane deep state, the insane administrative state that's been allowed to build up in our federal government.
Is that easily weeded out?
No, but we're going to get it done. No, I mean,
I'm just very happy about that.
You know, all problems look impossible from the outside, and then you get in and you chip away and you chip away and you chip away, and you aggregate smaller successes into bigger successes, and that's how you drive cultural change. I think what we're going to see in the coming weeks and months, as new cabinet secretaries come in, you're going to see statements from the top that will start to trickle down through the bureaucracy, that good actors in these departments will be promoted, bad actors will be pushed to the side, and over time you can really drive cultural change even in these massive behemoth federal agencies. But that's going to require political will, that's going to require commitment and dedication. And the reason that I'm so enthused about the team that President Trump is putting together is that I think they're all people with the will to get these sorts of things done.
Yeah.
And I'm excited for the next couple of years.
Well, that's our poll for today, is do you trust Trump's judgment on his cabinet pick? Sounds like you're a yes.
So far, they've been great. Lee Zeldin will be outstanding at EPA. Yeah. This is a congressman with just a ton of experience on environmental issues and on dealing with the federal government, which is a key piece of this. We'll see more cabinet appointments in the coming days, coming weeks. But so far, so good.
Would you accept transportation secretary?
I don't know if I can follow Mayor Pete. I mean, you know.
The qualification standard is super high.
Yeah, the Dems always hate on, you know, Republican appointees. Then they put Pete Buttigieg in charge of transportation.
He was the mayor of South Bend, Indiana,
and
Mr.
then he
Scharf.
Disappeared for 6 months on paternity leave when you had, like, the biggest supply chain crisis in American
train
history.
Train wrecks.
You had train
spills.
Wrecks, airplanes falling out of the sky. There was that big ship in the Suez Canal.
It's like, maybe the worst section of transportation catastrophes.
Everything
in the
was coming apart, and Pete Buttigieg is off on leave. I think you should throw your name in it.
You would be an improvement.
They're holding him up as a potential Democrat presidential candidate now for 2028. I mean, this is the worst transportation secretary in the history of transportation or secretaries. What are these people thinking?
Oh, man. Will Sharf in studio with us right now. I'm looking at the attorney general appointment as, to me in my mind, maybe you could redirect my thought on this, is the most important pick that he has to make. How do you feel about where that might be headed?
Yeah, you know, J.D. Vance said during the campaign that other than president, AG may be the most important slot in the federal government. And I think particularly in terms of all the change we need to drive in DOJ, that rings true to me. Based on the press reports, they're considering some really outstanding candidates, including, I'll say, you know, there have been press reports that Andrew Bailey, our attorney general, is under active consideration. Bailey and I obviously fought out a bitter primary, but, you know, I wish him luck. I think he'd be an incredible representative of the state of Missouri in the federal government, and I think it would be a pretty incredible thing for him to be up there. I think that when you look at the Department of Justice, you're going to have these careerists, these deep staters in that department setting landmines for whoever President Trump appoints. Those first couple months are going to be decisive. We have to get our landing teams in. We have to get good staff in. We have to get some of the sub-cabinet level officials there confirmed quickly, and we've got to sort of grab a hold of that beast before it starts tearing us apart. You know, back in 2017, the sort of the careerists pressured Jeff Sessions to recuse himself from the Mueller investigation or from anything relating to the campaign. That was a huge mistake that did real damage to the Trump administration. We have to avoid landmines like that this time around. But every name that I've seen in the press, you know, being considered for that position has been outstanding. You know, another other than Bailey's, Matt Whitaker, former acting attorney general. Mm-hmm.
Cardinal fan.
He's a guy with just, yeah, that's right. He's an Iowa guy.
Yeah.
He's a guy with just tremendous experience in that building who I think would also be a great pick. I haven't seen a name, though, so far that's really made me scratch my head. So I'm excited to see what the transition puts out there.
We have less than a minute left here, but Senate leadership, how important is it?
I think Senate leadership's incredibly important. You know, President Trump's been talking about, you know, the appointment process, you know, how the Senate is going to handle his appointments, you know, vacancy appointments, that sort of thing. We need good leadership in the Senate. I'm not going to take a position on who I think would be the best. A lot of conservatives are really pushing Rick Scott hard. But one way or the other, we all need to be rowing in the same direction. And we need a Republican Party that's really committed to getting the job done and not just talking about it now that we have the reins of power in our hand.
Yeah. Let's not get in our own way here.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's not get in our own way. And I also do like Donald Trump's picks for cabinet. They aren't like, they're kind of from a few different places in the Republican Party. That is good for representing a larger Republican Party. Will Sharf, anytime you're free, we've got a microphone open for you.
Great to be with you guys. Thanks so much for having me.
And congratulations to you. You worked very hard on this victory, and we are glad to be able to have you on here to talk about it. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be back in just a minute with more Annie Fry Show. Good boy.